Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, and KBDH, San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf.
Fame, no matter how substantial, can be fleeting over time. Even a star of great magnitude can end up a footnote to history. Even Bing Crosby, who enjoyed a high degree of fame in the mid-20th century, is largely forgotten today. Even before Bing, there was an entertainer of national renown, a beloved comedian who stepped out of the minstrel shows onto the stage of the Ziegfeld Follies. A blackface comedian who also happened to actually be black. His name was Burt Williams, and he is the subject of a book by my guest, author, historian, and performance artist Camille Forbes. The book is called Introducing Burt Williams, Burnt Cork, Broadway, and the Story of America's First Black Star. Camille F. Forbes, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Forbes, tell us, how famous was Burt Williams?
Burt Williams was by far, as would later be said about him, the greatest comedian on the American stage, black or white. And what that meant was that he was of a prominence that, despite or regardless of his race, he was so very prominent that he was nationally known, that he actually was not just a matter of being famous as a black comedian, but actually being of a standard that was exceptional for any performing comedian of his day.
Well, how unusual was it for an African-American, or in his case a black person, to be, because he's not actually African-American, I should say.
That's right.
I think legend tells us that, you know, blacks played maids and porters and that was it.
Well, Burt Williams, what he was able to do, both during his career with George Walker, the black American, and as a solo performer, was actually able to do, well, quite a number of things. One, being able to take their musical to Broadway, to perform on Broadway in 1902, which was absolutely groundbreaking. Also to perform abroad in London and do a command performance then. But what they were really able to do that was remarkable and important as a kind of what you might consider the first generation of professional African or black performers, I was about to say African American, is that they were able to begin to call the shots, that they were able to negotiate contracts, creating and setting some standards for what their treatment would be like. Now, mind you, there was always a challenge of how this would actually be played out, and that was a concern during the career of Williams and Walker together and Williams alone, making sure that these contracts were respected and upheld. But they were actually able to achieve quite a lot in terms of really upgrading the standard of the quality of treatment, the quality of the theaters that black performers performed in, and they're really making their company so very prominent that both cast and crew of blacks were really among some of the most famous people in entertainment during the time who really got their start alongside Williams and Walker.
And they would be names that we would know, like Fannie Brice and Will Rogers and people like that?
Well, actually, I'm specifically talking about black performers like Will Cook and Bob Cole, other people, some of whom these names have been forgotten by some, but who have been incredibly important in American musical history. So you find that entertainment history, of course, focuses on theater, but also focuses on contributions to American music. Many of these performers are people who are being sort of rediscovered or re-remembered, if you will, who really got their start in the late 19th century and became absolutely essential to making possible later achievements. Generations of performers like Noble Sissel and Ubi Blake, who would later become famous, were very much influenced by the generation of performers that included Williams and Walker. So you have, on the one hand, some of those performers during the time who were so essential to influencing the entertainment field or industry, but then also those later generations who were able to take Williams and Walker and their company as a kind of model for what might be possible, as when Shuffle Along was able to open in Broadway on Broadway in the 20s, which was a kind of return to Broadway for black performers.
That was Hubie Blake's show,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we get into the sort of the specifics of Burt Williams' act and his career, can you paint us a picture of the world in which he lived?
Well, I would say one of the things that's kind of amazing is the degree to which he was always aware of this kind of baffling contradiction as his star rose, that he was quite aware of segregation, experiencing the contradictions of, on the one hand, being and becoming a star, but then also having to face the demands and requirements of a segregated society, even in the North, even in New York, where it was not officially on the books. It was very much practiced during the early years of Williams' career. The NAACP didn't yet exist, so the practice of bringing sort of forth court cases to argue against these segregationist practices were undertaken, but it wasn't as much in practice. With, you know, there wasn't a kind of organization that was really pressing for that. So what you find is in the 1890s, when Williams is in California and up and coming and becoming a performer, elsewhere in the country, the system of Jim Crow segregation is really being solidly established and supported and reified. Plessy versus Ferguson is 1896 supporting separate but equal in accommodations and all kinds of the public sphere, which was really affecting the population as a whole, and Williams would be always affected by some aspect of that as long as he was in the States, though he would avoid performing in the South throughout his career.
Did he never perform there, or he just tried to never perform there?
Well, he would go as far south. He actually went as far south as Richmond. There's a story that Williams and Walker did perform once in the South, but in fact, during their career, when they were out west, they performed in Colorado. They never really went south. They actually performed when they headed from west to east. They actually performed in the northern part of the country. So they actually never had performed together actually in the South, but were well aware of the kind of limitations that they would face, and the aggression that they indeed did face when they were in the rural mining towns, etc., performing out west. So it wasn't something that was exclusively practiced or apparent in the South. They experienced it elsewhere as well, so they were very selective about where they would perform, although that would not always protect them.
Given that minstrelsy was such a popular form of entertainment in America at that time, did audiences always know when they were watching Burt Williams that he was black?
In the early days, I doubt that they did. It was really as the two gained fame that they were obviously known to be. And, of course, there was also the interesting sort of representation, which was that Walker, a dark-skinned man, never wore makeup, and Williams, a light-skinned man, did. But in reviews, et cetera, there was always the kind of unveiling, if you will, of Williams as a black man performing in blackface. That was where the reveal happened, so to speak. So audiences going in might not know that, but as they gained fame, of course, they were well aware of that. And often in interviews, interviewers would refer to that, the sort of contrast between the light-skinned man and the dark-skinned man that he played on the stage.
We're speaking with Camille Forbes, and her book is called Introducing Burt Williams, Burt Cork, Broadway, and the Story of America's First Black Star. Now, Dr. Forbes, tell us a little bit about Williams' act. What was it like? If we saw him on stage, what would we see?
There's quite a range in terms of what Williams did throughout his career, but what I enjoy most talking about, so I'll focus on that, is his performance in vaudeville. And I tended to focus on that kind of representation because it was such an important moment in his career, really, when he had to go out on his own once Walker could no longer perform. And he would do an assortment of things. He was a great storyteller. And, of course, because we're not actually talking about stand-up comedy, he was never directly acknowledging or speaking to the audience, but he was able to create a kind of intimacy when telling stories. And this, in a vaudeville setting, which was well known to be high-energy, frenetic, and he would really bring a kind of studied subtlety to his performance in the storytelling. It was said that he would never use a gesture that moves more than, say, 5 or 6 inches from his face, that he was always able to animate his face, though his features were flattened by the use of this burnt cork. He modulated his voice, although he did not speak in a southern accent. He used what he referred to as a Georgia dialect. So he had a kind of a drawl when he spoke.
But not the kind of Amos and Andy thing.
No, although there are times when it's more there are times when it's more exaggerated, and then there is a degree of control in it. But some others would refer to it as a darky dialect. That was sort of the language used to refer to it. But it was interesting how he really chose to be very specific about the terms he would use to describe it. And then he often, say during the course of a vaudeville act, would tell a couple of stories, whether long or short. He would sing some comical songs, often generally not necessarily topical, but about things of the time, not really political is what I mean to say. So he might have a song about his landlady, about being constantly ignored by people, because of course he was playing a character that would come to be known as the Jonah Man, who was the wretched, unfortunate, friendless man who never could depend on anyone. So that was a kind of refrain in many of these songs. And then he became famous for a poker pantomime, which he would do as sort of an encore, usually, where he would play all the roles of a kind of a set of people playing poker, with all of the different expressions of disappointment, elation, anticipation, which was very well received. And of course, he'd always sing Nobody, which was his most famous song. He was constantly receiving accolades for it, and over the time he had a bit of a stick that he developed when he would perform it.
When life seems full of clouds and rain, and I am full of nothing and pain, who soothes my thumping, bumping brain?
Nobody.
When winter comes with snow and sleet, and me with hunger and cold feet, who fair cares 25 cents? Go ahead and get yourself something to eat. Gone.
Nobody.
I ain't ever done nothing to nobody.
Recorded in 1906, that was Burt Williams with Nobody. He's the subject of a new book called Introducing Burt Williams, and the author, Camille Forbes, is my guest. Did he write his own material?
Usually he didn't. Interestingly, he would, when he did, he wrote the music, not the lyrics.
Well, who wrote that song?
This was Alex Rogers, who was a partner of his, one of the many performers with whom he worked when he was working in the Williams & Walker Company. So Alex Rogers was somebody who was very attuned to Williams' talents and strengths, and he wrote a number of songs for Williams during those years.
It's a fascinating book, but tell us a little bit about the arc of Williams' career. How did he get into show business and so forth?
Well, his beginning is rather interesting. Having moved to the States from the West Indies, from the Bahamas, when he was just a boy, his family chose to go to California. And in California, living in Riverside, he gained exposure to medicine shows. And watching medicine shows at this time, prior to the Food and Drug Administration, so this was both a time and a place for people to get their tonics, elixirs, and medicines, so to speak, while also experiencing and enjoying entertainment. And Williams became a barker, an advertiser for these shows. He did not actually perform in them, but I think it came to be for him his kind of first exposure to performing. And his parents, immigrant parents, were not very excited about the possibility that he would become a performer. They were very interested in him continuing his education. But the story goes that his father saw him one day in his role of barker and was enthralled by what he saw his son able to do. He'd known that he was rather talented prior to that, but it seemed that there was a real gift that Williams had. So he went from there to San Francisco. In San Francisco, he would meet up with George William Walker, who had actually traveled from Kansas to California. Once they teamed up together, working in minstrelsy, they would eventually go out on their own. And Walker, being a very sort of assertive and business-minded person, really encouraged Williams to go for that. The two of them actually would make their way east, heading towards New York, really, which was known to be the land of opportunity, the entertainment capital of the country. And they would eventually... One interesting thing I think that has to be noted is they actually began with Walker as the comedian of the duo. So they were Walker and Williams. But an interesting and important change happened in 1896 in Detroit, where Williams became willing to really commit to wearing burnt cork. And when he did that, it sort of miraculously, he transformed himself. And they changed their billing. Williams became the comedian. And they went on, they would later go on, of course, to fame in New York as Williams and Walker. And in New York, they went into vaudeville and would eventually go into black musical theater, where they really made their mark together. Of course, eventually Williams would go on alone, and he would do vaudeville and get that wonderful invitation from Florence Ziegfeld to be a featured act in The Follies.
What years was he with The Follies?
Years. He began in 1909, and taking 2 years off, he would stay in it until 1919.
Wow. And were there any... you mentioned in the book some films. Did he actually make some films also?
He did. Fish is still in existence, which is a short film based on one of his stories. There is also A Natural Born Gambler, which is... The greatest kind of detail in it is his poker pantomime, which is recorded in that. It was thought that he may have been in other movies, but they've either been lost or these are just unverifiable. But what is interesting, and back in February, I had the pleasure of participating in a screening of some footage of Williams's that was never made into a movie that the MoMA has.
Just some raw footage that was shot of him?
Exactly. And we're still trying to determine exactly what that footage is. It's not long enough to be a feature, but what's interesting is that it presents Williams in an altogether different way. It certainly seems from the material available that he is cast as a leading man, which he had never been.
Interesting. So that would definitely have been an influential film had it ever come to pass, huh?
Absolutely. So that's a very exciting possibility in kind of introducing and reintroducing Williams to an audience who might also have some exposure to this side of him. Of course, understanding that it's not so much a re-release of a film as a kind of piecing together of a film that might have been possible,
yeah,
shall we say.
Uh-huh. Well, obviously, if he played the Ziegfeld Follies, he had a large following of white people who enjoyed him performing.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any kind of backlash? Did black audiences like him also? Or
they did. I think what would become important and problematic over time is how he seemed to compare to Walker, who seemed much more of an activist among, and I'm thinking here among the black audiences, that it seemed that to some that Williams was not as assertive as a race man, the term would be that would be used during the day, that he wasn't pushing enough, advocating enough for the changes to both the entertainment industry and the society as a whole. Now, he and Williams, Walker rather, had always been dependent on a white audience. Even though they always had a core black audience that was loyal, the places where they performed, it was absolutely necessary that they also have enough whites in the audience who were willing to pay these ticket prices and support them. So that was a big part of their bread and butter. They couldn't afford to ignore that audience. But what was interesting is that when Williams went into the Ziegfeld Follies, there was both excitement about his being in this sort of premiere review, but also worry for a number of reasons. Some of the performers were concerned that this big-time comedian would overshadow them. And, of course, also some of those concerns were specifically racial in nature, that they were concerned that Williams not appear on stage with white women who were featured in the Ziegfeld Follies at the time. And it was said, Williams himself had said, that he had a gentleman's agreement with Ziegfeld in which he agreed that he would not appear on stage with white women. What's interesting is that by 1912, he was on stage with white women without any apparent concern or worry among audience members or cast members.
Hmm.
So eventually things would sort of shift in that way.
Well, Camille Forbes, how did you become interested in Burt Williams? What drew you to the subject?
I had been, actually as a grad student, thinking about black comedians, of contemporary black comedians, and really wondering about the early influences and sort of the trajectory of early performers who might have influenced the later performers that I was interested in looking at. And I was encouraged to take a good long look back in history. And what I found as I was doing this research is I was running into the name Burt Williams, or Egbert Austin Williams when the full name was listed. And what struck me is that the references to this comedian always remarked on his being the most prominent comedian, the greatest comedian of his time, without necessarily a specific reference to his being the greatest black comedian, which signaled to me that there was a kind of prominence to this man, and yet I'd never heard of him before. And I'd ask people, had they heard of this figure before, and they were entirely unfamiliar with him. And what that really struck me as I was came to understand the kinds of achievements possible that he and his partner George Walker were able to make happen during their time. So I became interested in, not so much interested in looking at those contemporary comedians, and a lot more interested in looking at Williams himself and getting a sense of his story. And that really sent me off into looking at his life, but not only his life, the various venues in which he performed, that he performed in The Medicine Show and Minstrelsy, Vaudeville, early film and radio. He traveled so much throughout the entertainment industry, and it seemed really important to locate him in American history, American entertainment history, and of course, black history, or African American, though he himself wasn't African American. So, but he was influential nonetheless, and I wanted to examine all of those things.
Well, it's an exhaustive and very entertaining book. It's called Introducing Burt Williams, Burnt Cork, Broadway, and the Story of America's First Black Star. And the author is Dr. Camille F. Forbes. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I'll be back again next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.